From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, coming to you this week from Tampa and the Republican National Convention. Presidents hope, and these days likely pray, to influence the economy. They can directly influence the world. American presidents have not been shy about leading the country to war. They make friends and enemies, trade deals, and can set a global tone. Where would Mitt Romney take American foreign policy? This hour On Point, Mitt Romney and the world. You can join the conversation. Have you heard Mitt Romney's tough talk on Iran, Russia, China? Who do you trust on international issues, on war and peace? Are you looking for a reset here or not? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll go to the world in a moment, but first to Paul Ryan. Big speech last night here in Tampa. He was tough on President Obama. He got an enthusiastic reception from the crowd in the hall in Tampa. Here he was, going after appealing to young voters and tying President Obama's policies with high unemployment among recent college graduates.
College graduates should not have to live out their 20s in their childhood bedrooms, staring up at fading Obama posters and wondering when they can move out and get going with life.
Fading Obama posters. David Frum is in Tampa, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, now contributing editor at the Daily Beast and Newsweek and at CNN. His latest book is Patriots. David Frum, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much.
And a special bonus, who's been listening closely from the state Mitt Romney hopes will host the next summer White House, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, David.
Hey there.
Hey, David, you've written a lot of these speeches. What did you think of the VP on the ticket last night, the VP contender? What did you think of Paul Ryan?
Well, from simply a technical point of view, it was a very effective speech, a very well-done speech. A little inside baseball, the lead author on that speech was Matt Scully, with whom I shared an office in the Bush White House. I think he is the most talented of the current generation of Republican speechwriters. He also wrote Sarah Palin's speech in 2008. I wonder what it is that has the Republican Party deploying Scully's talent always on vice presidential speeches, not presidential speeches. Ryan came to this convention with a huge communications problem. He is a very high-risk choice for a presidential nominee who normally prefers low-risk choices. With Ryan, you get a big agenda, very specific, that has a lot of people who are not going to like it. And Ryan's main job last night was to make himself a smaller target for the ticket as a whole, and in that he succeeded, although sometimes at the cost of saying some things that were a little misleading.
Let's listen a little more, Jack. I know you were listening in. A lot of people were. And the philosophy that he wants to bring in, we've seen him actively exercise it on Capitol Hill. But here he was pinning the Romney-Ryan philosophy as distinctly different from President Obama, saying America was about building yourself up.
When I was waiting tables, washing dishes, or mowing lawns for money, I never thought of myself as stuck in some station in life. I was on my own path. My own journey, an American journey, where I could think for myself, decide for myself, define happiness for myself. That's what we do in this country. That's the American dream. That's freedom, and I'll take it any day over the supervision and sanctimony of the central planners.
Supervision and sanctimony. Jack Beatty, Paul Ryan channeling maybe a little bit of his favorite Ayn Rand right there.
Yes, I haven't heard central planners or read it in his speech probably since the 1930s.
It's high time.
I suspect that had the Ayn Rand background to it. But, you know, I thought it was an electrifying performance. And he spoke the central Republican faith. Lincoln stated it. He called it the right to rise. That's what makes America distinctive. And again, he went back to that. And you could see people, actually, I saw Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. He was crying listening to it, because they were having their basic faith affirmed. It's a shame, I mean, David alluded to this, that at the same time, the speech was so deceptive. Here's what a blogger on Fox News wrote. To anyone paying the slightest bit of attention to facts, Ryan's speech was an apparent attempt to set the world record for the greatest number of blatant lies and misrepresentations.
That was Fox News,
Jack. That was Fox News, slipped into a single political speech.
Like what? There's this honest 42-year-old face from Wisconsin. Like what?
Well, for example, the plant in Janesville that he intimated, I guess, that Obama – that was closed under Obama. It was closed in December 08. President Obama wasn't inaugurated until January 09. He spoke about the, President Obama didn't endorse the Bull Simpson. Well, he helped to sabotage Bull Simpson. He was on that committee.
He was on it.
He voted against it. On and on and on. You see different headlines. The 6 worst lies, the 5 worst lies. It was not a very admirable performance. And I wonder if many Republicans waking up who were thrilled are reading this kind of thing and saying, Paul, don't be a cheap politician. Rise to the level of our best faith and tell the truth.
Well, I mean, David Frum, he certainly presented himself as a guardian of a philosophy that he described, portrayed as under attack in the Obama years. How do you think that's going to play beyond that hall of cheering supporters last night, David?
The feeling that something terrible has been lost in America is, I think, a very, very widespread one. A lot of people interpret that differently. But even though we're in a technical recovery, most Americans are worse off than they were in September of 2008 before the onset of the financial crisis. And a lot of Americans remain worse off than they were in 2000 at the peak of the last economic cycle. There is a pervasive loss of hope. When you segment the electorate by race and age and educational level, you will see, despite the high unemployment number, surprising levels of optimism among blacks and Hispanics of all educational levels. But among whites, there is a tremendous mood of pessimism, with white non-college graduates being the most pessimistic group in the country and the only group in the country who say that they do not expect their children to have a better life than they do. And white college graduates are not a whole lot more optimistic, although they're somewhat more optimistic, than the white high school graduates. So Ryan is tapping into something very profound, and a lot of things come together: economic anxiety, discomfort with the pace of ethnic change driven by mass immigration, which the president wants to ratify through his immigration proposals, and deep pessimism about America's place in the world, and a plurality of Americans now saying the 21st century belongs to China.
Here's Ryan last night saying that the President Obama just doesn't have it anymore. It began with such anticipation and, said Ryan, now comes to such a disappointing, as he would like to see it, close.
It all started off with stirring speeches, Greek columns, the thrill of something new. Now, all that's left is a presidency adrift, surviving on slogans that already seem tired, grasping at a moment that has already passed, like a ship trying to sail on yesterday's wind.
Jack, you can feel the loss of hope in this country. You can feel it in many sectors in this country. But here it is, these two parties now arm wrestling over who this time out will represent hope to the majority of Americans. I mean, you know, you talk about the right to rise. Americans know what the inequality is in this country. But it's Paul Ryan saying, come on, cut the constraints loose. Take freedom and up you'll go. How do you think people look at those two kind of conflicting views of the world, Jack?
Well, I think if they take if they just take the Ryan hope, you know, on its own terms, who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want an economy that's growing? Who doesn't want anything other than mobility in a society? The question is how you get there. I thought his emphasis on the fatigue of the Obama administration really was quite accurate. I mean, who can doubt when you see the president sometimes that yes, his heart is in it, but sometimes you just sense that he, you know, that it's that the whole thing is just wearing him down. And when Paul Ryan said, why should we believe that the next 4 years will be any different from these? Well, what is the answer, Mr. President? I don't know that the president has given a good answer to that. Maybe he will next week. But I think his election depends on answering that question Paul Ryan raised.
The president's got a few more gray hairs. He jokes about it himself. And there's Paul Ryan, 42 years old, and you can feel the youth. David Frum, while we've got you, I want to ask about another speech last night, Condoleezza Rice. She got a delirious reception in the hall, talked about foreign policy.
We can only know that there is no choice, because one of two things will happen if we don't lead. Either no one will lead and there will be chaos, or someone will fill the vacuum who does not share our values. My fellow Americans, we do not have a choice. We cannot be reluctant to lead, and you cannot lead from behind.
David Frum, you were there. Axis of Evil, maybe your phrase back in the day. Here's Condoleezza Rice up front again. Big reception, saying America needs a more aggressive foreign policy, really digging at the Obama administration there. Given the record of the administration that she worked with, what did you think of that critique last night, David?
I think with Condoleezza Rice's speech and the reaction to it, you have to separate the words, the lyrics, from the music. The lyrics of a forward and aggressive foreign policy, I think, go nowhere in this hall. This is a Republican Party that is very weary of foreign commitments and that is very jaundiced about expense. Many of the people associated with aggressive foreign policy are near Mitt Romney, I'm very skeptical, as I've written, that Romney will do it. I think actually he will exercise a much more cautious foreign policy even than Barack Obama, overwhelmingly for fiscal reasons. This party's priority is to keep taxes low and get them lower. And to do that, today's reality means no wars. You can't do it. But the music that Condoleezza Rice was speaking to was that feeling of loss, that feeling that the place in the world that this country had risen has risen to is in jeopardy. There's a great passage from Advice and Consent, the famous potboiler of the night, political potboiler of the 1950s, about how people of a certain generation had seen America rise over their lifetimes like a golden dream. That's what they're speaking to, and that's what those delegates feel is being lost.
David Frum, we're very glad to have you with us. The latest book from David is Patriots. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, we'll talk more with you tomorrow. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, coming to you from Tampa, Florida, and the Republican National Convention. Paul Ryan speaking last night, Condoleezza Rice speaking last night. Tonight, of course, Mitt Romney takes the podium. We're looking this hour at the world and Mitt Romney, or Mitt Romney and the world, what we might see in a Romney foreign policy if his campaign takes the White House. Mitt Romney took off for Indianapolis yesterday and an American Legion gathering there. He told veterans that President Obama's foreign policy is not the right choice for America.
For the past 4 years, President Obama has allowed our leadership to diminish. In dealings with other nations, he has given trust what's not earned, insult where it's not deserved, and apology where it's not due.
Mitt Romney yesterday trying to put out some foreign policy chops with the American Legion in Indianapolis. Of course, he's back in Tampa today with us in Tampa right now. First, Mitchell Reese, foreign policy advisor to Mitt Romney. He held several top diplomatic positions in the George W. Bush administration, was U.S. chief negotiator in the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization during the Clinton administration. He is president of Washington College. Mitchell Reese, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And with us, and it's great to have him back with us, Gideon Rockman, chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Financial Times, quite an eye on the world himself. Gideon, wonderful of you to be with us today.
My pleasure.
So, Mitchell Reese, you know Romney and you know the inner workings of his foreign policy thinking well. When he's talking in Indianapolis yesterday about the Obama administration giving trust where it's not earned, insult where it's not deserved, an apology where it's not due, what's he talking about?
Well, I think he's really talking about what we've seen over the past 3.5 years in terms of the Obama administration's philosophy and some specific policies that they've adopted. I think the trust given that's not deserved starts with the Russian reset, which was trumpeted by this administration as a significant foreign policy accomplishment.
Hillary Clinton had the reset button from Staples in her
exactly
hand.
Right. And what we've seen instead is that the Russians have not enhanced their cooperation in Afghanistan or Iran. They've opposed American policy to try to replace the brutal Assad regime. And we've also seen an extraordinary wave of authoritarianism inside of Russia, which has been stifling free speech and the democracy movement that was starting
we've
really
seen
to get
that.
Started.
Was it not worth a try?
You know, that's an interesting question. It's again, I think it has to do with judgment and timing. And I don't think that you pay it forward. There was a movie that perhaps many people remember with Kevin Spacey called
Sure.
Pay It Forward.
Yeah.
That's really not the way the world works, is that you don't extend benefits to adversaries unconditionally. And that's clearly what the administration did with respect to Russia. But there's other examples as well.
Insult where it's not deserved, apology where it's not due.
Well, again, let's just talk in broad strokes. The Middle East peace process, placing unprecedented conditions on the Israelis before they even could enter into negotiations with the Palestinians. Unprecedented, clearly didn't work. than some of the public statements that have been critical of a foreign leader, a friend of the United States, Prime Minister Netanyahu. Again, not warranted, not deserved. There have been the reaching out to, not to our friends and allies, but to our adversaries, North Korea, Ahmadinejad and the mullahs in Iran. Assad was called a reformer at one point by this administration. So there are, again, a series of incidents that I think paint a tapestry of just poor judgment in the approach that the Obama administration has taken.
Gideon, jump in here. What about this this portrayal of the Obama administration as a kind of a softy apologist on the world stage? Americans, by the polls, seem to like the Obama foreign policy, a distinct majority anyway, not everybody. But what about the Romney portrayal?
Well, I think that I would put it a little differently. I think that Obama is an old-fashioned realist in foreign policy terms, in the sense that he, although he speaks in highly idealistic terms, actually the kind of foreign policy that he's been pursued has been quite coldly based on American national interests.
Mm-hmm.
And I think their defense, say, on the Russia reset would be, well, sure, you know, we did invest some hopes in Medvedev that didn't work out and so on, but the things that the U.S. was doing, they were doing essentially because they were in American national interest. They were trying to work with the Russians on Afghanistan, get the Russians into the WTO was, they think, beneficial to the U.S., a missile defense
shield,
and also the arms reduction treaty.
Mm-hmm.
That these are all things they would have done whether or not they thought Putin was a nice guy. It was because it's an attempt to just advance American interests.
Mitchell's saying naive to try.
Well,
you don't pay it forward in foreign policy.
I'm not sure what America actually has lost on Russia. I mean, I think one thing I would say in favor of Romney was, you know, maybe a couple of months ago, he was being absolutely slammed for saying Russia was the number one geopolitical foe. And I think that was an overstatement. But as Putin becomes less and less attractive in the way he's behaving as he's back in the Kremlin, I think America may have a Russia problem. But again, but that's not really Obama's fault. I think events shift, and all presidents shift in response to them. For example, the Arab awakening and so on. Obama didn't anticipate that, but I think he played it as well as he could under difficult circumstances.
Let me ask you both, if I may, about the base assertion in Romney's speech in Indianapolis yesterday. For the past 4 years, he said, President Obama has allowed our leadership to diminish. Gideon, first you, and I'll come to you, Mitchell.
Well, I think he has, to some extent, quite deliberately taken a step back. I mean, I think that the Democrats and perhaps many Americans believe that under George W. Bush, America had got overstretched, overextended with two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and that after the financial crisis, you had to concentrate on rebuilding American domestic strength because that's where the foreign policy strength comes from in the end. And so, yeah, I think he wouldn't say that he's relinquished American leadership, but trying to cut back on American commitments, I think they probably have done and attempted to do that.
Mitchell, what's the evidence of less American leadership? And what about the notion that maybe the U.S. was leaning too far forward with two wars and an overextended military and fiscal issues at home? What about the argument it was time to look home a bit while we managed abroad?
Well, let's broaden the lens through which we look at national security. It also includes our support for human rights around the world, and it includes our support for free trade. This administration has not initiated a single free trade agreement. It's let linger the three it inherited. In the meantime, the Chinese have negotiated 9 free trade agreements in Asia and Latin America and are negotiating 5 more. On human rights, the president was silent when the people took to the streets to oppose the mullahs in Tehran back in June of 2009. He has not, aside from one speech in Cairo, been a forceful advocate for human rights around the world. So again, that's all part of a larger picture that we need to consider. Now, you mentioned that the American people support, by and large, the president's foreign policy. And I'd just like to draw a distinction between counterterrorism policy and foreign policy. The most successful aspect of this administration has been in counterterrorism policy. The president has supported keeping Guantanamo open, the Patriot Act, military tribunals, indefinite detention, and ramping up the drone strikes.
Not to mention the Osama bin Laden assassination.
Oh, you just mentioned it, okay? And all Americans should celebrate that. But the reality is that those policies were built on a foundation that was laid by the Bush administration. So there's been continuity in counterterrorism policy. And the irony is, of course, the Senator Obama ran against all of those issues when he was campaigning the first time. He's now embraced it and is trying to elevate it to be the centerpiece of a foreign policy. Counterterrorism policy is not an operating principle for your foreign policy view. The foreign policy issues, I think, have been
sure
far less
like
successful.
Sure seemed like one in the Bush administration. I mean, we two wars, and it was all about reaction to 9/11.
Let's talk about the Obama administration. Again, Russia, China, the Middle East, Syria. There are some serious problems with the way this administration has approached foreign policy. And again, that also includes human rights and free trade.
We've got callers just on this point. From Washington, D.C., Nathan is calling. Thanks, Nathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. My question is, I know the Republican Party has been pretty critical of the president's foreign policy, but in my view, he's been pretty aggressive, whether it be in Libya or the surge in Afghanistan. And even regarding Iran, he said that military options are on the table. So I was wondering if there are any large, substantial differences between the president and Governor Romney's foreign policy plan, or if these criticisms are more of typical campaign rhetoric.
Let's go right to that. I mean, Gideon, the notion is out there that, in fact, it's a tougher rhetoric. It may be a little more bellicose rhetoric, but, in fact, the notion is out and about one way or another that there's, under the covers is not that different, Romney and Obama. Right. Obama's been pretty tough on a lot of security issues.
And I think one of the big issues that Mitchell touched upon is how seriously do you take campaign rhetoric? He's totally correct. Obama campaigned for all sorts of things, like closing Guantanamo, that he didn't eventually do. Romney, for example, has said he'd label China a trade manipulator, currency manipulator, on day one. Will he do that? I suspect because it's day one, he may have to. But there are all sorts of other things where, you know, circumstances change and presidents change. So I think it may sometimes be more interesting to look at temperament and at the people that they surround themselves with. And although a lot of Romney's rhetoric has been pretty tough, pretty neocon, my sense of the man, of course Mitchell would know him much better, is that he is actually fairly pragmatic. And some appointments, like appointing Robert Zoellick as his national security transition guy, suggests that he's in the tradition of the more sort of internationalist, realist foreign policy.
Doesn't he have a lot of neocons in his circle as well? I mean, what did I hear? Read 17 out of I don't know what from that circle. Elliot Abrams, you know, rumored to be a potential top official in a Romney administration.
Absolutely. And it's true that I think even in appointments, there's an element of coalition building. So you'll probably see faces from different wings of the Republican Party, which means that, in George W. Bush's words, the decider, the president, will matter enormously. And we're guessing, but I suspect that Romney isn't a particularly aggressive George W. Bush type.
Mitchell, what about it? Not much difference, one line of assertion between Obama and Romney, despite the Romney campaign rhetoric.
Well, again, I just urge people to pay closer attention. Free trade, the differences couldn't be more stark. Human rights, another big difference. Defense spending. The Romney administration is committed to a goal of at least 4% of our GDP for defense spending, not the devastating cuts that President Obama's own Secretary of Defense say that are being teed up for our military. I think there's also tone issues as well.
Republicans and Democrats have set up this thing where there are going to be cuts if they don't come to some kind of fiscal
agreement.
But
that's a separate issue. That's with sequestration.
Yes.
But we're talking about the Obama cuts for the Defense Department, which, again, Secretary of Defense...
But Romney talks about $500 billion in cuts. That's the fiscal cliff.
But we're talking about something that's going to kick in on December 31st, unless it's addressed before then. But we're talking about the Obama's defense policy and defense spending plan is going to have $500 billion of cuts over the next 10 years. That's separate from sequestration. And so, again, the Secretary of Defense, Panetta, has already said that would be devastating to our military. It would throw hundreds of thousands of Americans out of military-related jobs. It also will make it more difficult for our veterans that are returning back to find good jobs here in the United States. So, again, there are significant differences between how these two men would approach foreign policy.
At a time of such fiscal distress and when a lot of Americans are war-weary, what is the point of guaranteeing, of committing 4% of GDP, not as a, you know, not tied to particular needs, but as almost a philosophical commitment of a chunk of the American pie to the Pentagon? Why not some restraint at this point? It's not only Democrats who have said we need some cutbacks here, and it's not only people outside the Pentagon.
Well, I think it has to do with some underinvestment and a lot of capital building that we've been postponing for a number of years in terms of our ships, in terms of some of our aircraft. But again, it's 4% of our GDP. We're the wealthiest country in the world. We should be able to afford that. And it's not simply for us. This is what makes the world more secure. It provides
stability
and security.
I mean, that's one message, but the other one is we're going off a fiscal cliff and we've got to take serious steps to rein it in.
That's absolutely true, and a lot of that has to do with entitlement programs, I think far more than the defense budget.
Well, Pentagon's pretty big. Bill in Iowa City, Iowa, thanks for calling. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I'm a retired Marine, and I was highly offended when Romney made the idiotic statement that if he was president, Iran would not get a nuclear weapon, and if Obama was reelected, they would get a nuclear weapon. That's idiotic. He has no
Mitchell,
way
what do you say? Former Marine in Iowa doesn't like to hear that kind of talk, and it was very prominent.
I think the point there is that the president, in the eyes of many, including some in Tehran and certainly those in Israel, doesn't quite have the same amount of credibility as Governor Romney has on this issue. And there's reasons for that. This administration has opposed sanctioning the Iranian Central Bank. This was the fifth round of sanctions. The president opposed it until it became inevitable because Congress was forcing it to go through. It has not approved some of the transfer of the military weapons that Israel has requested that would bolster its defensive capability. It also has declined a request by General Mattis for a third carrier battle group to be positioned in the Persian Gulf region. So there are some steps that the administration could do.
But where's Romney's credibility on this? I mean, he doesn't have a big foreign policy background. Neither did Barack Obama when he became president. But at this point, he's got campaign rhetoric, I grant you.
Neither did Ronald Reagan until he became president. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think the world learned that he meant what he said, and he said what he meant. And I think the same is true of Governor Romney.
Gideon, what do you make of that assertion? If I'm elected president, Iran won't get the bomb. If President Obama stays in there, they will. Is that fair talk? Is that wild talk? Is that just campaign?
I think it's slightly rash talk, because in the end, the only way to stop, sure way to stop Iran getting the bomb may be military action. And, of course, everybody's going to try sanctions and other things, but it looks like Iran is intent on getting a bomb, and at some point they will, unless there is a military intervention. Does the U.S. definitely want to go along with that, given all the other consequences? Maybe that's the choice they'll make. Maybe it's a choice Obama would make, actually, in the end. But if Romney is implying that he's definitely up for essentially a war with Iran, I think that's not necessarily a commitment you want to make right now.
You're with the Financial Times. They're out of London. What about how the world looks at this choice? Americans will make the choice, but the world has a lot that rides on this as well, allies not least, the UK not least. Mm-hmm. What about the global perspective on these two men and American foreign policy going forward?
Look, I don't think there is a single global perspective. I think Obama remains extremely popular in Europe, partly because, as the Republicans like to point out, he does represent a slightly more kind of European view of the world in all sorts of ways, social welfare as well as other things. I think there are bits of the world where Romney would be more popular. Israel would be one. Poland, they haven't been terribly happy with the Russia reset and so on. Mm-hmm. Maybe even India, or George W. Bush had a very good relationship with the Indians. Obama slightly got off on the wrong foot with them. The Chinese, I think that all American presidents sort of fluctuate between confrontation and eventually coming round to them. But I think at the moment, actually, Obama and the U.S. in general have a slightly sticky relationship with China because of this pivot to Asia, which the Chinese see as an effort to contain them. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure they would expect that much different from Romney. So it's tricky. I'm not sure who they'd be reaching
for. And the argument that a Romney administration would be Bush-Cheney again, that's another one of the themes that's out there.
I would be surprised. I mean, because, events have changed. We are now 10 years on from 9/11. Bush-Cheney partly reflected the personalities, but they also reflected the times. Counterterrorism as the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy no longer, I think, quite makes so much sense.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the world and Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney and the world. We are in Tampa at the Republican National Convention, and we're talking about what we might see in a Romney foreign policy if the Romney-Ryan ticket takes the White House. Mitchell Reese is with us, a foreign policy advisor to Mitt Romney. He also advised Presidents Bush 43 and 41, and back further than that, he's president of Washington College. Gideon Rockman is here, chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Financial Times, and you can join us. How do you see America's position in the world right now? Strong enough? Too weak? About right? Do you want to see a bigger military, more lines in the sand from the White House? Who do you want at the helm to deal with Syria, Iran, Putin, Beijing? Here's Mitt Romney kind of setting out his perspective on national security and the world. This was last November in CNN's Republican primary debate. Mitt Romney said that unlike President Obama, he believes the U.S. cannot apologize for this nation's strength.
President Obama says that we have people throughout the world with common interests. I actually don't agree with him. I think there are people in the world that want to oppress other people that are evil. President Obama seems to think that we're going to have a global century, an Asian century. I believe we have to have an American century, where America leads the free world and the free world leads the entire world. President Obama apologizes for America. It is time for us to be strong.
That's Mitt Romney last fall. Gideon, have you seen President Obama as apologizing for America?
No, I haven't. I mean, I know that's a very common charge, but I think if you read what he says, I think what he was attempting to do in the early stages of his administration was to deal with the fact that if you looked at the opinion polls, America was highly unpopular in large parts of the world. And that's not just, you know, a question of hurt feelings. That's actually damaging to the United States, because a lot of what you're trying to do, you're not trying to do by force, you're trying to do by persuasion. And so I think Obama went out there to try to use the cliche, reach out by at least attempting to understand where other people were coming from and moving a little bit towards them. Maybe at some points he overstepped, but I think the effort was worth making. And I think to some extent it has been effective, although, you know, America's ratings are now slipping back in the Middle East again. So, you know, I don't think he's an apologist, no, but I know the Republicans disagree.
Mitchell Reist, what about, I mean, was it not perhaps time for a little American modesty after those wars? The soft power issue arose, America facing a lot of global disenchantment, and President Obama trying to address that. Is that not a pragmatist view? Is it time for a, you know, large and in charge America again? Would that win us friends around the world?
I don't think we have to take our shirt off and beat our breast to tell everybody how powerful we are. Most of the people around the world know that.
So,
and but again, I think the president's approach really has backfired. As Gideon said, the United States is now less popular in the Middle East than it was at the end of the Bush administration. According to Pew polling data, we are less popular. We are less well liked.
Will it be more popular with the very, very Israel friendly policy that Governor Romney has made much of on his visit there recently?
The foreign policy in the Middle East goes well beyond just Israel, as important as that is. And so, again, it's not just a question of being liked. The United States needs to be respected. And I think that the administration really has misunderstood the one for the other. And so in trying to become liked, I think that the respect that countries have around the world for us has slipped. And not just our friends and allies, I think especially among our adversaries. The Iranians continue to march towards a nuclear weapons capability. The administration tried to reach a deal, I think naively, with North Korea. North Korea rewarded that faith by testing a ballistic missile. So I think that there are a variety of examples here where the administration has tried to reach out, as the president indicated he would, and really it's proven to be a failed policy.
Be tougher, Condoleezza Rice said last night. Paul Ryan intimated last night. Mitchell Reist, Gideon Ruckman, please stand by with us right now. From Washington State, Bellevue in Washington, is Congressman Adam Smith, Democrat from the 9th District in Washington. That's South Puget Sound region, ranking member of the House Foreign Services Committee. In July, he wrote a big critique of Mitt Romney's foreign policy in Foreign Policy magazine, headlined The Romney-Cheney Doctrine. Congressman Smith, thanks for being with us. What do you mean by the Romney-Cheney Doctrine?
First of all, I'm the ranking member on the Armed Services Committee, not
forgive
on the
me,
Services
of course,
but,
forgive me.
Look, I think, you know, and listening to comments here, I strongly disagree with several things that were said. I mean, first of all, Mitt Romney implying that to say that we have common interests with other countries in the world, that he disagrees with that, that we are, you know, sort of this sole power out there that must bend the rest of the world to our will because they are just so oppressive and wrong. I mean, I think that's exactly the type of rhetoric that's going to push people in the wrong direction. Yes, there are oppressive regimes out there. We need to make sure that we confront those oppressive regimes. But the notion that we don't have major powers in the world with common interests, I think, is ridiculous. We need to work with the European Union. We need to work with rising powers like India and Brazil. And yes, we need to find a way to coexist with China. This notion that, you know, moving into the next century, we need to figure out a way to once again dominate the world, I think, is incredibly dangerous. And I also feel that to say that President Obama is unpopular in the Middle East because he's, you know, somehow been too conciliatory. It's exactly the opposite. I mean, the reason that President Obama is unpopular in the Middle East is he has aggressively confronted al-Qaeda and similar affiliates, gone after bin Laden, been relentless in trying to stop, you know, the terrorist groups that struck us on 9/11 from doing so again, and he's been successful. And then also the idea that, well, he's tried to talk to Iran and North Korea and that's led to bad behavior is equally ridiculous. I mean, the bad behavior from Iran and North Korea has been there for a very, very long time. The president has also put in place one of the most aggressive sanctions regime against Iran that we've ever seen. I mean, there's no harm in trying to find ways to work with people. But what President Obama has shown time and time again is he's not going to blindly and belligerently smack people. But if we are not moving in the direction we need to, if U.S. national security interests are threatened, he will shrink in no way from asserting U.S. power to protect us.
Congressman, what's your evidence for this assertion of a Romney-Cheney doctrine? This is a kind of a Bush 43 redux in a Romney administration. Justify that.
I mean, the biggest evidence is forget the advisors from Cheney, Bush Cheney, that are working with Romney. The biggest evidence is the clip you played from Mitt Romney in the debate, saying that we need a new American century. I mean, that is the neocon doctrine that, frankly, even most Republicans came to dismiss by the time, you know, we'd reached the end of the Bush administration. The notion that, and this was the new American century, was the paper they put out in the mid-90s that said, basically, you know, we don't want any pure competitors. The United States has to remain the dominant power in the world, and essentially the only way we can advance our interests is by forcing them on the rest of the world.
Let's go right to that. Congressman, stand by. Mitchell Reese, what about it? This idea, and it is, we hear it again and again from the Romney camp, that a new American century is the right prescription. You hear Congressman Smith saying, come on, that takes us back to neocon land, and it's time for something where we reach out to more nations around the world and realize we're in this together. What about that?
Well, with respect to the congressman, I really think it's an oversimplification. The world is a complex place.
But this notion of another American century, if it's a simplification, it's a Romney simplification.
No. I mean, the way it's portrayed is a simplification. Of course we want the United States to remain the leading power in the 21st century. What's the alternative? As Secretary Rice said last night, either nobody leads, or China, or Russia, or a third country leads that will not have our interests at heart and certainly will not share our values. That's not a future that I think any American wants to embrace. It doesn't mean that we go around the world, you know, shaking our fist at people and, mm-hmm. and carrying a big stick. Mm-hmm. There's lots of instruments of foreign policy. Soft power clearly is an important one. The cultural attraction, the example that the United States sets is something that's very important as well. So, again, to just reduce it to a return to Bush-Cheney doesn't make any sense. It's really not accurate. It's not fair. But, again, have people think, what type of world do you want for the 21st century, and what's America's role in it? And I think most people would be much more comfortable if America is providing public goods, making the world more secure and prosperous.
Congressman, the National Journal here says President Obama's foreign policy is designed for a world in which power is dispersed. Mitt Romney has embraced a Reagan-esque policy of peace through strength. Mitchell Reese says, of course, you want to see the U.S. as the leading power. Do you agree, Congressman Smith?
Well, there's a couple things about that. Number one, yes, certainly we should be the leading power, but it's a lot different from what Mitt Romney said. I mean, he quoted President Obama as saying, you know, we have, you know, a lot of nations of the world in which we have common interests. And Mitt Romney blatantly said, I disagree with that. I mean, that, yes, I agree, that is a pretty narrow way of looking at it, but it's what he said. I also feel that the president has led. As I've said, Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda, in Libya, in a whole bunch of other places, we have asserted our power. But you also need to find some way to get along and work with rising powers in the world. I think.
You think the president is less popular in the Middle East because he's been tough on al-Qaeda?
Absolutely.
Really?
I don't think there's any question.
Al-Qaeda has that much support in the Middle East?
Pardon? No, it's not that. It's because of the attacks that the president has done. We constantly hear that the drone attacks in Pakistan.
Oh, the drone attacks. Well, yeah.
The drone attacks in Somalia. That basically, in our effort to go after the terrorists, people feel like, in some cases, innocents are being killed, and that it's too much use of power to confront that. It's not a matter of al-Qaeda being popular. It's a matter of that part of the world resenting precisely what the Romney people are arguing we should do, which is assert our power. And in some cases, yes, you have to do that. When you've got a group of terrorists who have said they're going to kill as many Americans as they possibly can, you have an absolute obligation to assert U.S. power to stop them, and the president has done that. But
Adam Smith, Democratic congressman from Washington's 9th District, ranking member of the House Armed Services Committee. Congressman Smith, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Let me get a call right here from Westboro, Massachusetts. Robert. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason why I'm calling is because I'm becoming more and more apprehensive between the link of American exceptionalism and Mormonism and the kind of jingoism that we're hearing from former Governor Romney.
What do you mean? What link?
Well, Mormonism has a kind of understanding that America uber alles, pardon the German phrase, I'm not suggesting that Romney is a Nazi, of course I'm not, but the fact is they see America as doing no wrong, as the chosen nation, and I think that could significantly, without him admitting it, perhaps even to himself, the whole sense of America's foreign policy and jingoism, and he has been talking, he even mentioned about invading Iran in the primary debates.
Yeah, Robert, thanks for your call. Let me take it to Mitchell Reese, if I may. I think we've got the point there. What about it? American exceptionalism is part of the large Mormon thinking, but does it come into Romney foreign policy? Is that a fair or just right out of bounds?
I'm not going to even acknowledge that remark.
Why not?
Because I can't see that it has any legitimacy whatsoever. If we want to have a conversation about foreign policy, let's have one. But to bring in a person's religion...
Well, it is a religion that where the North America has a very distinctive part in the whole sort of global epistemology of Mormonism.
Well, perhaps you're more of an expert on Mormonism than I am.
No, I'm sure I'm not.
Then I'm not comfortable, and you shouldn't be comfortable talking about this. This is just not an American thing to do. And again, it's the same thing by people who denigrate the president by calling him a Muslim. It's exactly the same thing.
I don't think we're into denigration here. I think we're into an open-minded conversation.
But again, it's being used as a way to make a broader point, to smear somebody.
We're not looking to smear here. We're looking to have a full and frank conversation about what's going on.
Let's have it about foreign policy. Here's
the candidate. Here's the country. Here's the whole picture that our caller raises. Worth considering or just out of bounds and wrong?
Well, I'm really not an expert on Mormonism. So, I mean, it seems to me that a candidate's biography and their beliefs are important, obviously. I mean, where they come from and, Romney's core beliefs are, as he would freely say, and I think as we'll hear tonight, Mormonism is important to that. So I don't think it should be a completely illegitimate to look at, well, what does Mormonism say about the world? But I think it should be done with sensitivity.
Absolutely.
And of course it's a tricky area, but I would be uncomfortable with saying it's completely out of bounds.
Let's come back to China, if we may, Mitchell Reese. Mitt Romney has said, there's currency manipulation here and I'm going to take that to them my first day in office. Now, you've said we need more free trade agreements. Well, there's a lot of trade between the U.S. and China. What happens if we go down that road?
Well, it's not just the currency manipulation. It's also intellectual property protection. And I think that this isn't simply a position that the governor has adopted. I think that there's broad agreement by people across the aisle that China is not a fair trader and that something needs to be done. The question is, what needs to be done and how can the Romney administration address that? If you've been listening to what Glenn Hubbard has been saying, he's also made the point that many economists inside China, including central bankers, have been talking about them rebalancing their currency. And so, again, I think that there's actually more common ground here than people might want to admit. And so, again, I don't think it's in anybody's interest, neither ours nor China's, for there to be a confrontation. But clearly something needs to be done.
I've heard some skepticism on that front. Here was Stephen Roach. He's a Yale professor now, former chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia. He talked with the BBC NewsHour this week about a hypothetical economic trade war between the U.S. and China that he suggests could result if Romney wins the presidency and follows through on that threat to declare China a currency manipulator. Here's Roach.
The irony or the tragedy of this is that by closing down trade with China, which this type of scenario allows for, given the fact that we have a multilateral trade deficit with 88 countries, the Chinese piece just goes somewhere else, and we don't fix things for American workers. The actual recession the U.S. goes into makes things a lot worse. The unemployment rate goes easily back above 10%, and the whole thing backfires.
Gideon Rockman, how about it? This is a big relationship. It can be a testy relationship. But Mitchell Reese says ultimately people are going to see common interests here.
Well, I think that there is an incoherence in the Romney presentation, because on the one hand he is saying, I'm the free trader. On the other hand, he's saying on the first day he'll take a step which could potentially trigger a trade war. However, one doesn't want to overstress the impact of this declaration that they'd make on the first day. It would only open the way to doing a whole series of other things, so they could get off the train towards a trade war quite quickly if they wanted to. I think more broadly, the Chinese are reasonably cynical about this. I mean, they think that basically all American presidents come in, with the possible exception of Obama, actually, saying, I'm going to get tough with China, and then they kind of back off. And with Romney, I suspect they might be right once again, if that's the view.
Mitchell Reese, we've just got a minute. Take us back to first principles here with Mitt Romney and the choice Americans will be looking at in November. Is it a big choice on foreign policy? And if it is, what would they be choosing in terms of our relationship with the world if they go with Governor Romney?
Well, I think you'd have a president that articulates to the American people a lot more consistently what our foreign policy interests are. This president really has outsourced that to the generals, certainly with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan. I think you'd also see an America that's a much more constant friend to our allies around the world. I think you'd see somebody who supports free trade. I think you'd see somebody who would be a certain trumpet on human rights. And I think you'd find that the United States would be both more secure and more prosperous.
There's the perspective from the Republican National Convention in Tampa. Next week, we'll hear from the Democrats in Charlotte. But I'm very grateful to all of our guests this hour for their insights today. Gideon Rockman, Chief Foreign Affairs Correspondent for the Financial Times. It's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for sitting down with us here in Tampa. And Mitchell Reese, Foreign Policy Advisor to Mitt Romney, President of Washington College, with us here in Tampa. So good to talk with you. Thanks very much for coming by.
Thank you.
Listeners, we are in Tampa tonight, looking at the run-up to the big Mitt Romney speech. Join us then. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.